The Gospel of Mark, chapter 2. Let's start off in 23 and read all the way down to chapter 3, 6. Here we go. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some ears of corn. The Pharisees said to them, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath.'" Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" They remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. This is a story about Jesus and the Sabbath, more specifically about Jesus' take on the Sabbath versus the Pharisees' take on the Sabbath. And it's easy to brush right past because the Sabbath is not a part of American culture at all. Would you agree? I mean, it used to be at least that Sunday was a day of rest a long time ago, like when my father was a child, like a century or two ago, right? I mean, everything was closed on Sunday. There were no sports on Sunday. Can you imagine a world with no sports on Sunday? There was no 7-Eleven. There was no email, no cell phone, no 24-hour grocery store. I mean, for a day of the week, the world shut down. There was church, if you're religious, and that was about it. Now, obviously, all that's changed. Now Sunday is a day for shopping and Instagram. But all that's changed. But even then, even 50 years ago or whatever, it was not the same thing as a Sabbath. Now, in order to understand what Jesus is up to in the story, I need to rewind, take you on a 10-minute detour, and hash out a theology of Sabbath. If you can wrap your head around that, then maybe, just maybe, you and I can figure out what Jesus is up to. That said, turn to the left to Genesis chapter 1, the opening story, 10-minute detour. Here we go. Genesis 1, let's pick up the story. At the end of creation, chapter 1, verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very, what? Good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, done all the way, in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So, on the seventh day, or the Sabbath, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it, what? Holy. Because on it he rested from the work of creating that he had done. Notice three things about the seventh day, also known as the Sabbath. First off, the Sabbath is written into the rhythm of creation. God created the world with a rhythm to it, almost like a time signature. After all, God is a musician, right? He created music. The 12 notes in a musical scale are embedded in the created order. That's why we have not made up number 13 or 14 or 15. God is the one who thought it all up. And he made creation with a rhythm. You work for 6 days, then you rest for one. You work for six, you rest for one. That's how God set up the universe to thrive, but more than anything, how he set up the human body, you and me, to thrive. After all, you and I are made in God's image and likeness, meaning we are called to mimic and mirror God to the world. God worked for 6 days, and then he what? Rested. In the same way, you and I were made, hardwired by God, to work for 6 days and then rest. To go against this is to go against the created order. It's like playing music with no rest. Can you imagine that? It would be horrific. It's going against the created order. Now, secondly, the Sabbath is not the same thing as a day off. Notice the text says God blessed the seventh day. How intriguing is that? He blessed a day of the week and he made it holy, or kadosh in Hebrew. Now, this is the first time the word kadosh or Hebrew or holy is used in all of the Bible. And the rabbis make a big deal about what's called the principle of first mention, which is a rabbinic hermeneutic that essentially says the first time you read a word in the scriptures, it's basically an intro, it's a setup for that word all the way through. Now, that may or may not be right, but either way, this is the first time you read about what we call holiness. And notice what God made holy was not space, but time. Every major world religion in human history and in the world today has sacred space, a shrine or a temple or a holy mountain or a holy river in India. But for followers of Yahweh and his son Jesus, it's not about sacred space, but about sacred time. There is a day in the week set aside for God. Heschel writes this, next slide. Jewish ritual may be characterized as the art of significant forms in time, as architecture of time. Most of its observances, the Sabbath, the new moon, the festivals, the sabbatical and jubilee year, depend on a certain hour of the day or season of the year. The Sabbaths are our great cathedrals. Isn't that beautiful? There is a day set aside for rest and worship in the created order. Now, there's lots of freedom. You run everything through that filter. Is this rest and is this worship? But notice how ambiguous that is, right? For you might define rest differently than I define rest. For example, exercise. I'm a runner. Like some of you, to some of you, running is a form of rest and worship. To others of you, it is hell on earth. Right? Don't run on the Sabbath at all. Do what's life-giving, right? That's the idea. A day out of the week that is set, that's holy. The word holy can be translated separated or dedicated to God. It's a day that is set apart from the other six and is dedicated. It's set aside for rest and for worship to God. It's holy. And then third, if you're taking notes, the Sabbath is wisdom, not a command. There's not one command in the text, at least not right here in Genesis, that says, you know, you need to take every seventh day off for rest and worship. It just said God rested and God blessed the seventh day. And that should be more than enough incentive for you and me to do the same. Now, sadly, we don't take a hint that well. And so later on, it is commanded by God. At Mount Sinai, in the Ten Commandments, Moses writes this, next slide. Remember the Sabbath day, which is fascinating language to me. Don't forget it. By how? By keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, mom and dad, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and it's retelling the Genesis story, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So it is commanded at one point in the scriptures, but then later, it's interesting, in the New Testament, it's actually abrogated. We don't read a single command in all of the New Testament to remember the Sabbath. What does that mean? That means it's wisdom, but it's not a command. And the scriptures are actually full of stuff that is wisdom, but is not commanded by God. There's no verse that says, thou shalt sleep 8 hours a night. You don't have to. You're welcome to sleep 5 hours a night. Now, the average human being needs 7 to 9 hours. I need about 12, but... You don't have to. You're welcome to run on 5 or 6. It's probably not wise. It's probably not that smart, but you're welcome to. You're not in sin. There's no command that says, you know, thou shalt not eat dirt. Go ahead. You're welcome to. You're not in sin. You don't need to beg and plead for mercy. You're just dumb, but you're not, you know. There's no command that says, thou shalt not drink 50 cups of coffee a day. Go right ahead. I'm sure God is not angry with you. He's probably avoiding you, but he's not angry. I know your wife is avoiding you, right? But it's not sin at all, at all. It's just not intelligent. It's just not wisdom. In the same way, the Sabbath is not a command that you're stuck into and feel guilty if your week was crazy. In fact, I actually kind of missed half of my Sabbath this week, which is over the top rare for me, but it was a crazy week, and I'm not in sin. I don't need to beg for God's mercy. That said, I'm tired today. I'm feeling it. Because to go against this is to go against the created order. You and I would be a fool to disregard God's wisdom. Now, that's it. That's kind of a basic nuts and bolts theology of the Sabbath. But here, what happened is that over time in the story of God, the Sabbath became a list of rules, a list of do's and don'ts. Here's what's okay, here's what's not okay. Here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. We have this bent as a human being. I don't know what's wrong with us, but, well, I do actually. It's called sin. But we have this bent to turn wisdom into rules. For example, there are 613 commandments in the Torah, or the first five books of the Bible. Now, 613 is plenty, in my opinion. Like, we don't need any more. I'm okay, thank you. 613 is more than enough. But what happened is that over time, an oral tradition grew up around the 613 in the Torah and added 1,500 more on top. It was called the Mishnah. So by Jesus' day, you had the Torah, 613, from God, and then on top of it, you had the Mishnah, 1,500 more, not from God, from the Pharisees, basically. From the religious police of the day. Now, this is an interesting thing. All the Torah said about the Sabbath is don't work. Remember it, keep it holy, don't work. That's it. Is that easy enough? Sound life-giving? Yep. Set aside a day out of your week. Don't forget about it. Make it holy, rest, worship, and don't work. That's it. That's all you need to know. But the Mishnah said, oh, no, we need to drill down on this one. And it separated work into 39 categories. And it says, here's what you could do, and here's what you could not do. Some of it you would expect, no farming, no hunting. Others of it you would not expect. You were not allowed to tie or untie a knot. You were not allowed to sew more than one stitch. You were not allowed to write more than one letter. Sound absurd? All of that from one command in the Torah. Remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. One ancient Jewish writing says this, the rules about the Sabbath in the Mishnah, festal offerings and sacrilege are as mountains hanging by a hair, for scripture is scanty and the rules many. Right? All you get in scripture is, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy, don't work. That's all. But then you have rule after rule after rule, one stacked on top of another, stacked on top of another. And then Jesus comes along. Enter Messiah Jesus. And Jesus had a whole other take on work and rest. One more time, now circle back to Mark 2, and let's work through the text. Here we go, 23. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfield, he sat on a walk, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some ears of corn. His disciples are hungry, right? And the Sabbath is a day to eat, right? Go ahead. The Pharisees said to him, look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? Now, it's not unlawful in the Torah. There's nothing in the Torah, nothing in the 613 from God that said, you know, you're not allowed to pick corn and eat corn. There was a law in Deuteronomy about how you were not allowed to farm, like no sowing and reaping. And then the Mishnah said, well, here's what that means, boom, boom, boom. And there was a law in the Mishnah that said you are not allowed to pick corn and eat it. So the disciples are breaking the Mishnah, the oral tradition, not from God, from man, but are not breaking the Torah, the 613 from God. And Jesus, comes as no surprise, is a fan of the Torah. Absolutely not one stroke of the pen will drop out of the law, I read this morning, Jesus said. But he's not a fan of the Mishnah. He's not a fan of the oral traditions of men and women. He's not a fan of religion, in my opinion. So watch what happens. He answered, 25, have you never read what David did? Which, this is so beautiful. That is a cutting, sarcastic, funny dig, right? Have you never read? These are Pharisees. That would be like me saying to Dr. Gary Beshears, the head of the theology department at Westman, hey, Gary, have you never read the Old Testament? Have you not done that yet? You should try it sometime, right? Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God, the temple, and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful for only priests to eat. This is the show bread put out on the Sabbath day for the priests. He also gave to some to his companions, just like Jesus and his disciples. Now, Jesus tells this story from 1 Samuel 21 about King David. The story, if you know 1 Samuel, takes place at a time in David's life when he had been anointed king by the prophet Samuel, by God, but he was not yet enthroned as king. In fact, he was on the run from King Saul. And David goes to the temple, and he's hungry and worn out and tired, on the run. And he says, "Do you have any bread here?" "No." "Well, I mean, just the showbread, which is for the priests." And David actually, with his men, eats the bread. And it's a fascinating story. But what's interesting to me is that Jesus could have quoted Exodus 20. Said, "Hey, guys, listen, all the Torah says, all Moses said was remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. That's it. Will you lighten up a bit? I mean, seriously, come on." That would have been more than enough. But instead, Jesus quoted this obscure, off the beaten path, funky story in the Hebrew Bible about King David and the Sabbath. Why? Well, because Jews around the time of Jesus were waiting for a new David, because of prophecy after prophecy in the Hebrew scriptures about a coming Messiah who would be the son of David, meaning the descendant or the great, 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 great times, whatever, grandson of King David. And this new David, this Messiah, would become king not only of Israel, but of the world. And he would usher in the kingdom of God, or the rule of God over the earth. And he would make everything right. By quoting from 1 Samuel, Jesus is basically saying, "Hey, listen, not only do I have authority over the Sabbath, but I have authority over the world. I'm the king. I am the new David that you have been waiting for." Then 27, he said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." Don't you get it? Seriously, you have it all wrong. The Sabbath, the seventh day, was made for man. It was a gift from the Creator God to you and me to enjoy. You're not a slave to it, not the other way around. It's not a legalistic, oppressive, religious, stuffy rule that you have to follow. It's a gift. I mean, you have it all upside down. So, 28, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Wow, at the surface, this is a story about the Sabbath. But underneath, this is a story about Jesus, of the fact that he is way more than a rabbi. He is the coming king of Israel. Now, keep reading. Chapter 3, verse 1. Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue. The odds are in Capernaum. This is fast becoming dangerous ground for Jesus because he's on the Pharisees' turf. And a man with a shriveled hand was there. That word shriveled can be translated deformed, right, or warped. I mean, a man there who is handicapped, basically, in the hand. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. And that is the religious spirit right there. Looking for a reason to accuse. Good thing, I would never do that. Religious people would never do that, right? It's that heart posture of kind of arms crossed. I wonder what he's all about. A bit cynical, for sure, critical, quick to jump in and point out what's wrong. That is the heart of a religious man or a religious woman. That is the heart of Phariseeism. And they are watching him to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Now, is healing a good or a bad thing? It's fantastic. And what better day of the week to heal on than the Sabbath, a day set aside for a life-giving, a day for restoration, for God to renew and restore you from the ground up. So, but the Pharisees are just waiting for Jesus to step out of line, and watch what happens. 3, Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Okay, so Jesus is about to pick a fight, right? He's a provocateur. He is not mellow. "Dan, do me a favor, stand up. Good morning. How are you today, Dan?" No, stay standing. Yeah, you doing well? So can you imagine Dan just standing up in front of the entire synagogue, right? And then let's say you have a deformed hand. Let's say you have something that you're embarrassed about that made it actually illegal for you to enter the temple because of, or let's say you weren't allowed into church on the weekend. You had to stay in the foyer. Stay standing, right? And then this rabbi, Jesus, has the audacity to make you stand up in front of everybody. And then you're stuck there standing, all right? Let's keep reading. Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" This is so brilliant. I mean, who's going to say to do evil? Like, who's going to say, well, no, Jesus, to kill? No. Like, everybody is quiet. They remain silent. So he looked around at them in anger. Wow, interesting that Jesus does get mad. And deeply distressed, torn up on the inside, upset at their stubborn hearts. This phrase, stubborn hearts, is really slippery to translate into English, because in English, the heart, or at least in the English worldview, the heart is the seat of your feeling. But in Hebrew, the heart is the seat of your feeling and your thinking. It's honestly a bit closer to the English word for mind. This text can be translated close-minded. Jesus is angry that the Pharisees are close-minded, shut off, not open to new ideas. Oh, I haven't heard it that way before. I haven't heard it that way before. That's probably wrong. That heart posture, that religious kind of tradition heart posture, Jesus is not a fan of. And he said to the man, Dan, stretch out your hand. And the guy wasn't Dan, but you know what I mean, right? Stretch out your hand. This is in front of everybody. How embarrassing. He stretched it out. And his hand was completely restored. Look at that. Dan's hand is amazing. That's fantastic. Well done. Right here. Take a seat. Thank you, Dan. Well done. I mean, that, can you imagine, right in front of everybody, in front of the entire synagogue, what you are embarrassed about more than anything else, what you are hiding under your cloak, Jesus says, yep, put that one out in the open. And then right in front of the Pharisees who are just waiting, would he have the audacity to heal? Yes. Right in front of everybody. Now, you would think that the entire synagogue would throw a party. Okay, it's time for some hummus and pita. Let's barbecue. Let's whatever. I mean, you think everybody would, right? But instead, then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. How crazy is that? After a healing. And what's interesting to me is that the Pharisees and the Herodians were enemies. The Herodians were Jews who supported King Herod, the puppet king for the Roman Empire. The Pharisees stand against Hellenism or Greek culture kind of seeping into Jewish culture. They said, no, no, to draw a black and white line. This is what it means to be Jewish. Sabbath, dietary laws, all this, which is why Jesus gets in so much trouble for Sabbath and dietary laws. This is what it means to be Gentile or what it means to be Roman or Greek. Crystal clear line of demarcation between the two. The Herodians, on the other hand, were pro-Rome, stood for Hellenism. Pro-Herod, pro-Rome. They were with Gentiles on a regular basis, which means technically they were unclean, just like a tax collector. But here, the Pharisees and the Herodians have nothing in common except they both hate Jesus, and they both see Jesus as a threat to the status quo. Because if Jesus is right, everything is about to change. And they team up, not just to run Jesus out of town, but to plot Jesus' murder. Because this rabbi has to be shut down. Now, this is a story about the Sabbath, but at the same time, it's a story about so much more. It's a story about Jesus' way over against the Pharisees' way, or you could put it this way, about kingdom versus religion, or about life versus the rules. And not all rules are bad, but you know what I mean by the rules. Now, it's interesting to me the juxtaposition between the way of Jesus and the way of Phariseeism. To the Pharisees, the Sabbath was a rule, rigid and unbending. Now, I cannot say this enough, and I know I said this last week, but listen to me. We think of the Pharisees as evil, right? At least I do. Growing up in the church, I remember like second grade, I mean, the Pharisees are like demonic, right? Are they good guys or bad guys? Bad guys, you know? I mean, that's like my early childhood, you know, evil. Like, it's like Nine Inch Nails and the Pharisees are right next to each other. Nine Inch Nails is playing in Portland. How crazy is that? Anyway, moving on. Don't go. Don't go. Satan is there. But moving on. And that's how I think of the Pharisees. But the problem is nobody thought of the Pharisees that way in the first century. They were well respected. They were at the top of the religious food chain. They were the evangelical conservatives, the Bible-believing men and women of the day. They were the ones who were more serious about Torah, more serious about God's mitzvot or commandments, more serious about what it means to be holy, more serious about God's kingdom than any other sect in all of Judaism. fact, the parallel between first century Phariseeism and 21st century American evangelicalism is scary. Phariseeism is alive and well. Now, here are a few signs, 10 to be exact, that you have a bit of a Pharisee in you. You ready? Here we go. Number one, you like rules a lot. Are my people here? Yes, well done. Secondly, you think of yourself as the guardian of right and wrong. It's your job to defend. Three, you are quick to criticize and slow to compliment. That's not me at all. Four, you see the bad, the not good enough, the ugly in every situation, but so often you miss out on the beautiful stuff that is all around you. Fifth, you just wish people were more like you. I mean, the world would be such a better place. Am I right? Sixth, you don't eat and drink with people far from God. When Jesus is at a party with tax collectors and sinners, you're not there. You're at church. Seventh, every new reading of the Bible is guilty until proven innocent. Your mantra is, that's not the way I've heard it before. And that may be right, but it may be wrong. Is your authority the text, or is your authority your tradition? Eighth, the rule is more important to you than the reality, right? Think about to the Pharisees, the rule, do not work, was more important than a man with a deformed hand in need of healing and God's heart for rescue. Crazy. Ninth, it's about the issue more than the person. I see this all the time. Not in me, but in you. I see this all. We get fired up about the issue. We say stuff about the issue we would never say to a man or woman's face. I think of gay marriage in the news this week, right? We say stuff about the political side of gay marriage that we would never say to a human being. Now, I know exactly where I stand. I stand for God's vision for human flourishing, which is a man and a woman locked in relationship for life. I stand for that. My wife and I stand for that. My church and I stand for God's vision. But that said, I'm not going to put a political sign in my front lawn that says vote no on whatever, because Chuck across the street is gay. Good morning, Chuck. How are you? Vote no. And Mark, two doors down, is gay. And Dwayne, after him, is gay. And right around the corner is a couple that's gay. And across the street is gay. And every single one are my friends and are in my home and are coming over this Thursday for the 4th of July and are loved by my family. And they know exactly where we stand. I'm not going to put a sign in my front yard. Now, I know exactly what I think. But to me, it's not about the issue. It's about Chuck. But when you are disconnected, when you don't eat and drink with people that are far from God, when you're not in friendship with people that are far from God, all of a sudden it's not about a human being, it's about an issue. It's about a law, it's about what you should or should not vote for. And it's fine to have your opinion. That's fantastic. But for the religious, for the Pharisee in you and me, it's about the issue more than the person. And then last, you hold yourself to a higher standard than Jesus. It's not a great idea. You know, it's just not. I'm sorry. Now, you're thinking, where did you come up with this list, John Mark? Is this off the internet? No, this is from my life, basically. I am a recovering Pharisee. It's been 3 days since I criticized a church. Right? This is me. This is all crud that is in my heart. And I have learned the hard way that Phariseeism kills. Right? It's not a coincidence that the closing line in the story, right after a healing, is then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might do what? Kill Jesus. That is what Phariseeism does. It kills. Wherever it sees life and laughter and joy and peace and healing and inclusion and kingdom, it has to snuff it out because it's not in on the party. That's why Jesus, in another spot, said to the disciples, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees. Interesting analogy. Yeast, I'm not a chef by any stretch of the imagination at all. But from what I understand, you put a tiny, little, dinky amount of yeast in a batch of dough, and what does it do? Spread really fast. in the same way, you put a tiny, dinky, minuscule drop of Phariseeism in your heart or in your church or in your community, and really fast it spreads. And it kills life wherever it sees it. Watch out. Now, on a much more positive note, let's compare and contrast the way of Phariseeism with the way of Jesus. To Jesus, the Sabbath was a day blessed by God. Out of all seven, a day that was a gift from God the Creator to you and me, the creation, to enjoy, a life-giving, healing day of rest and worship, to do no work, but to do good and to save life. That's what, to Jesus, the Sabbath was all about. It's not surprising to me that Jesus does most of his healings on the Sabbath. That's what the Sabbath is for, healing. And the Sabbath, in my opinion, is an ancient art form that we need to recapture. In a day and age where we move so fast through life, boom, 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 in a day, in a generation that is addicted to technology, we need to recapture this life-giving, healing day, this art form of rest and worship. To be honest, this was a turning point in my life, kind of when I first learned this years ago. We were about 3 years into the church plant. I did not have any children yet, and because of that, I had been working 6 days a week, 12 to 18 hours a day for 3 or 4 years, and I was done. I mean, I was dying on the inside, and my one day off was hands down the worst day of my week because I crashed. I mean, you worked that, a bunch of you know. Like, I crashed, I was dead tired, I was depressed all day, I was grouchy most of the time, and it was a day off, not a Sabbath. I spent most of my time kind of running errands, shopping, getting stuff, watching TV, doing whatever I wanted, catching up around the house, whatever, and it was hands down the worst day of my week. And then I discovered that book, The Sabbath by Heschel, and it was a turning point for me, and my wife and I started to tap into this ancient art form. And now, years later, for myself, my wife, my family, it is the best day of the week. We look forward to it all week long. We create anticipation. Two of my two youngest, Moses and Sunday, are both 4, which means they have no concept of time at all, which means every day it's, "Daddy, good morning. Is today the Sabbath?" "No, it was yesterday, Moses." "Tomorrow the Sabbath?" "No, Sunday, it was yesterday," right? No concept of time. But I mean, all week long is like a countdown. You know, put the kids to bed at night. "How many days, Daddy?" "3 days." "How many days, Daddy?" "2. And guess what tomorrow is? Sabbath." Like, all week long, we build anticipation. It's a journey to the day. Now, we Sabbath on Fridays because Sunday is a kind of crazy work day for me. And the majority of you, I'm guessing it's Sunday, but for my family, it's Friday. And which means Thursday is a flurry of activity. You really have to plan ahead in order to rest well. It's kind of weird, but it takes a lot of self-discipline and it takes a bit of planning. And so Thursday is a flurry of activity. We clean the house, we go grocery shopping, pay bills that are last minute or whatever. I do email, return a phone call or two, any last minute errands I need. It's just this crazy kind of busy afternoon. And then finally, we start to power down Thursday night. Go to bed early so we're not tired the next day. The last thing I do on Thursday is my favorite moment of every single week. I turn off my phone. Thank you, Jesus. And for me, my phone is connected to work. And even if it wasn't, for me, technology is a fantastic thing that has some serious side effects. And so for me, I turn it off, and I have 24 hours, no phone, no email, no social media, no text messaging, no internet, no nothing. I'm just free. Then Friday morning, we wake up whenever the heck we want, which is not early for me. not going to tell you what time. And I start off the day in the scriptures and in prayer, just no rush, like no time limit, as much as I want. I go into my study with a cup of coffee, and I sit and read and think and pray and just breathe and just be for a bit. It's a day to be, not to do. But then it's a celebration. We really believe that the Sabbath is a celebration of life under God's rule. It's a signpost pointing backward to the Garden of Eden and pointing forward to the age to come. If you've read the book of Hebrews, the eternal rest of God's people. So we do the kind of stuff that we would imagine in the Garden of Eden or in the age to come, which is basically eating. Like, that's what we do. We eat our way all the way through the Sabbath. Usually, if it wasn't that crazy, we could go out to brunch, and we just eat and eat and eat, and then we come home, maybe go to a park or go on a short hike, and then we come home in the afternoon. The kids go down for a nap. My wife does the same. That's life-giving for her. I get 3 hours all by myself. I'm introvert. Me, book, Jesus, I'm in heaven, right? I go, I journal, I look back to the week and think about what God's been up to. I look forward to the week ahead, think about what God is stirring in my heart, journal that, pray about that, think about that. Then the late afternoon, we just hang out as a family, go to the pool, whatever, sounds fun. Then at night, we eat, and that's what we do all day long. My wife and I make a meal together. There are rules, like not all rules are bad. There are rules about the Sabbath and the Torah. There are rules in my family. Certain things are off limits, like work, obviously, technology, video games, any of that kind of stuff. Shopping is off limits. We don't buy and we don't sell. It's fantastic. A whole day where I'm not a consumer. You know, I'm not an American for a day. Because the Sabbath is a day to have enough. I love architecture and design. So for me, the way I'm wired, I don't read a single blog or a single magazine because it's a day to thank God for what I do have, not dream about what I don't or what I want or what I think I need. We don't argue. Arguing is allowed. Like, there's no fighting allowed on the Sabbath. Like, it's just, I know that sounds weird, but if there's something that's not right, we'll talk about it tomorrow. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And you're not allowed to be sad in my house on the Sabbath. Jude, it's the Sabbath. Knock it off. Right? Like, there's this great line in Heschel where he says, it's a sin to be sad on the Sabbath day. That's a bit much, but I like his train of thought, you know? So there are certain things that are off limits. I'm a recovering Pharisee. I need a few rules, okay? I need a few, at least, all right? Give me grace. Now, all that to say, that's my life, but what happens is about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, all of a sudden I get my soul back. All of a sudden it's like, oh, there you are, Peter. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah, okay. By the time I go to bed at night, it's like, you know what? I can do this thing called life for another 6 days. But I'm actually up for it. It's a life-giving, healing day. Now, all that to say, that is not for you to copy. It's not a list of rules and do's and don'ts. You reimagine a day of rest and worship around you, your family, your life, your schedule, your makeup. I love time alone. To you, that's maybe torture, right? Don't do that, okay? Around, just run it through the filter. Is this rest? Is this worship? And when you set aside a day, oh my gosh, my friends, you have no idea how life-giving it is to your soul. All that to say, to end, this coming week, I have no idea what's in front of you. I head out for vacation on Thursday. It's fantastic. All right, there's a weekly rhythm of work and rest, and then a yearly rhythm of work and rest. I'm overdue for vacation. I'm tired. I'm a bit worn down, and I can't wait. Maybe you have a vacation coming up. If so, that is a fantastic place to practice Sabbath. And if you've never done this before, it's actually going to take a bit of practice. It is an art form. It's going to take a bit of self-discipline, which I know sounds weird, self-discipline to rest. Yes, actually. It takes a bit. But vacation is a fantastic place this summer to start with that. Maybe you're thinking, dude, I wish I had a vacation on Thursday. No, I don't get one. In fact, the week ahead of me is crazy, busy, intense. I'm stressed out about the week ahead. Listen, either way, wherever you're at, don't get sucked into Phariseeism. Right? Rules, guilt, shame, you. Don't watch out. And listen, on the other hand, don't get sucked into secular culture, not just religious culture, but secular culture is just as damaging. The fast-paced, 90-mile-per-hour, go, 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 addicted, plugged in all the time, wired all the time, produce. Don't get sucked into that. We need the church to be the church now more than ever. We need God's people to be God's people. We need you to stand as a prophetic witness over against the culture, to stand for a better way, where you are not defined by how much you produce, but you are defined by the fact that you are made in the image of God, and you work your tail off for 6 days a week, no more, and you rest and you worship. That's how God made you to thrive. This coming week, in the language of Moses, remember the Sabbath. A fascinating language to me. Don't forget about it. Don't forget. Set aside a day to be, not to do, for pleasure, not for production, for rest and worship, for the Spirit of Jesus to do his healing work in you, your body, your family, your marriage, and more than anything, your soul. What I love about the Sabbath is it's a weekly reminder to me that first off, the world goes on without me. I am not as important as I think I am. I'm just not. I shut down for 24 hours and the world is just fine. And secondly, that there is a God, a creator who made the world and everything in it. It's good, it's a gift, and I am not him. Let's pray. You know, I have no doubt that, all fun aside, there are probably, without doubt, men and women here with a shriveled hand, so to speak. Something in your life, maybe in your body, maybe in your relationships with family or friends or work, maybe in your mind, I have no idea, maybe an addiction. There's something in your life that is in need of healing. The Sabbath is a day for healing, and Jesus is a God of healing. We read last week, I have not come to call the healthy, but sick. So if that's you this morning, the invitation of Jesus is exactly the same. Stretch out your hand. He's a God of healing. To that end, there's a prayer room to my right, your left. We would love just to partner with Jesus and pray over you. If you need healing over your body, over your soul, whatever part of you, just make your way over there, and we would love to walk with you and pray over you. For the rest of you, let's just lean into this rest for a bit. Just lean into this God who is the creator of all things. And let's just worship. We're not going to open up the table for a bit. Take your time. Feel free to stand up right now if you want and stretch and worship. Feel free to stay in your seat. Feel free to put your hands up in the air and express with your body your worship of God, the giving of your life to God. Feel free to get down on your knees if you want on a cold concrete floor as a way to say, God, you are king. Whatever, take your time, and for a bit, let's worship.